Hi, I'm Sally Hughes and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to products and routines? Are they obsessive about their appearance or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Today's guest is Siobhan McSweeney. Siobhan is an actress and presenter who was born in County Cork in 1979. She took a science degree in Cork before moving to London in 2001 to study acting at Central. Her first role was in Ken Loach's The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Several film and TV roles followed before Siobhan donned the habit to play everyone's favourite nun, the Chemical Brothers loving, French despising, perennially eye-rolling Sister Michael in Channel 4's Derry Girls. Siobhan made her presenting debut with The Great Pottery Throwdown, which she's fronted since 2021. And in December, it was announced that Siobhan would be presenting the Irish version of The Traitors, the ideal gig for someone who's probably quite used to having her name misspelt. And believe me, I speak as a fellow traveller. Welcome, Siobhan McSweeney. But before that, a massive thank you to Clinique, who are sponsoring this series of Beyond the Bathroom. Clinique, where great-looking skin begins.
That's lovely. That wasn't at all cringe. Do you know what? I'm going to make this breaking news, because people will be fascinated about this, I've no doubt. I was born in 1977. There has been a mistake, and I don't, it's happened for so long now, I don't know what to do about it because it's such...
Yeah, tell it to the judge.
Right? Because of course, oh, you mean to tell me the actress knocked a few numbers off her age? I'm like, I don't know if this happened to you, but when I hit 40, I thought I was 40 for a lot longer than I was.
Right.
So I did an interview, and I didn't like... the journalist, and because I gave out to her, because she was like, when were you born? And I said, I just read last, you didn't ask Cillian Murphy this question. They never ask. And I had a bit of a thing. And then I gave her the wrong age, but not on purpose.
You just didn't know it.
I literally thought I was 40, but I think I must have been 41, turning 42 then. So I have just turned 47. There you go, dear listener.
You're still younger than me.
Well, I'm still younger than everyone who is older than 47. I don't give a shit.
No, of course not.
But because I'm a woman and because I'm an actor,
yes,
to knock the age off is not a neutral
thing.
Well,
we might as
well seemingly have knocked the age off.
We might as well get stuck into this before I even go to my prepared questions. It is a subject that fascinates me. I have never lied about my age. I'm perfectly happy. I was born in 1975. I turned 50 very soon. And I'm cool with that. Obviously, I'm cool with that.
I was going to say something glib, like if I looked like you, I'd be quite cool with my age as well. But that implies a sort of thing that I...
But that's also a qualitative thing, right,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
And I'm 57 and I will see you on my 50th.
Yes.
I'm very excited about that. But if I were the kind of person who lied about their age, why wouldn't you lie upwards? See, I would lie upwards.
I know.
Because I would rather somebody saw me and gone, bloody hell, she looks good for 60.
Right.
Than 35, life's been cruel.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think, you know, it's got to do with being an industry that fetishizes and a society that fetishizes youth, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also it speaks to my experience of working in my industry. That when you are younger, you can play older. When you're older, you can't play younger.
Right.
And that.
Well, in Derry Girls, you can.
Well, everybody thought that woman was older than she was. It was a really major thing that apparently in the casting of me was quite an issue because Lisa knew that Sister Michael was.
Had emerged like that from the womb, probably.
Exactly.
But the girls play younger, right?
Oh, the girls play younger.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, they do. Yeah. Some have a bigger gap than others. Yeah.
I was referring to them because actually, one of the things I love most about Sister Michael is that she's young.
Yeah.
She's just an old soul.
That's right. I mean, she's been jaded. You know, she was eye rolling in a habit at the age of three. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the girls have to play young. And Sister Michael was as cynical the day she was born as the day she'll die, you know?
We'll talk about Sister Michael a lot because I love her so much. But let's go back to 1977, not 79. Tell me about...
I'm free. I'm free. I have felt like such a fraud.
Let the record reflect.
Let whoever does my weird Wikipedia page and who changes it, let them go off and change it. Thank you very much.
So let's
and
go
get
back
a hobby.
To 77. Tell me about your mum and dad. What were they like? Are they like?
They've both passed away. Mm-hmm. They were like, I think they were very, I don't know how, nobody's really asked me that from when I was a young kid. What were they like? I can tell you what I thought my mum was when she passed away and how important my father was. But like what they were when I was growing up, I think they were a very typical kind of parent of that time, of the 70s. My mother was older than my dad. And she was part of that second wave feminism, women's lib, very education focused, but very upwardly mobile, like very smart. And I think she must have been a very smart young girl as well. Mm-hmm. She got scholarships to her secondary school. And I think, you know, she worked for the civil service and I think had to give up when I was born, kind of thing, and mm-hmm. that usual bullshit. And I think I was the great white hope. So a lot of, in a very beautiful way, and not at all in a, I didn't find it negative at all. She was very much, you will have the life I didn't have. My dad was very smart as well. They were both very witty, but not very sociable. My mum was great crack, but like they weren't out a lot. I don't know what they were like. They're gone now. And Mam fucked off when I was 27, so I've no fucking idea what she's like.
I've obviously watched so many interviews with you and read lots of interviews in the run-up to this, and your mother on her deathbed saying, would you not consider retraining as a teacher?
I know, and she, like, the idea of being an actor to both of them was a bit, was incredibly outrageous and mm-hmm. incredibly stupid. What they couldn't get over was how stupid I was being. And not to, you know, go, haha, fuck you. But it was, I understand why they were saying that. I was the first, you know, we were the generation that we could go to university. Why would you be an actor?
Right.
When, you know, there was no world where I could make a living as an actor. And why would I have wasted my education to do something like acting when that's being entertainment? It's not being useful, and it's being trivial.
Especially, I suppose, if you're a woman from a generation of women who's been denied a living.
Completely.
You wouldn't understand why a woman would opt out of a living, or not so much opt out, but make it very hard to earn a living, which acting undoubtedly is a hard way to
Absolutely.
Earn a living.
And you have to remember, they're looking at the telly, they're going right. to the cinema, they're looking at the stage, they're not seeing their clumsy, plump, obnoxious, buck-toothed, wild-haired girl on the telly.
Talk to me about that then. So set the scene for us, for anybody who wasn't around at that time. What kind of woman are we seeing on the telly?
I think in the 70s, I think the good life is a prime example of that.
Right.
You've got the sexy earthiness of Felicity Kendall, the one that everybody, that all the men want. And
me,
she's
Team Margot.
Right?
Obviously Team
Margot. Obviously. And all the women want to be Margot because she's outrageous and she's glamorous and she's haughty and she doesn't need anyone and she's the real fucking power.
Yeah.
But both of those women, well, for a start, they were English. And for a start, they were represented a class system which was alien to me, to my family, and to Ireland in general.
Right.
It was a received...
And was loads of your telly British telly?
No. No, it wasn't. No. In some bits of Ireland was able to get foreign telly, but I grew mm-hmm. up with just two channels, mm-hmm. RT1 and RT2, but it was on RT for a little while. And you know, being an actor meant being like Peter Ustinov was huge
yeah.
in Ireland as a raconteur
yeah.
and as a great man. And if, you know, I was sort of thinking about him recently. I was watching one of my beloved Poirots, and there he was with his moustache being outrageous. And I thought, jeepers, is it an actor I want to be, or is it Peter Ustinov? And I think every girl in their life...
There comes a time. She looks at Peter Ustinov and she goes, one day, mummy.
But you know, that ability to sit down, just the skill of a raconteur is very much, I think, a 1970s, 1980s skill.
It's also an Irish thing to tell a story.
It is. And it's
in a
rated.
Social setting. Yeah.
And it is very much rated.
Yeah.
It is a great thing to be able to do. But the women were very glamorous. Highly glamorous. I don't think that's particularly different now. I don't think anything has changed. It's just the idea of glamour, what that particularly is.
Often pointing at a canteen of cutlery, weren't they, women? On telly.
Yeah.
Or a caravan that you could win.
That's right. Or
very often.
I mean, all we do now is do the exact same, except we fold our arms and go, oh, Dave, what's he like?
roll their eyes.
Right?
Well, you ended up rolling your eyes at least, just not at men.
No, not at men. And thank God for her, because I wasn't going to be rolling my eyes at Dave.
So you would see these women on the telly, mm-hmm. and we know what your parents probably thought or the fears they had for you.
Of course.
What did you think, and why did you think, well, that could be me?
I didn't think I could be those women. I have in the past equated the desire for being an actor and the sort of secret knowing. In a very clumsy way, I've equated it to coming out and knowing that you're gay, because it feels like a secret. It feels like something you just know and you can't put your finger on. Now, I'm not gay and I've never had to come out. And I don't want to trivialise that experience in any way, but it's,
sure.
it's the closest thing. It is a very clumsy analogy, but it's the closest thing I can think of to just knowing. So trying to describe, like I remember on Irish television, there was a thing called Tops of the Town, which was, it's so random, where a lot of companies would sort of send in their amateur dramatics gang, and it was televised.
Love an Amdram.
Oh, love it. And I remember just being absolutely captivated by the red curtain. And even now, if I see a red curtain, there's a blue curtain behind you. But if it was red, I'd just, you know, David Lynch used it for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, it's, there's something Jungian about red carpet, even though that's, you know, there was no red carpets in the cave when we first started telling stories to each other.
Yeah.
But there's something in our lizard brain that recognizes a red velvet carpet. And there was something in my lizard brain that looked at that and started twitching. And I just knew. And then when I got older, my mother, with her notions, sent me to elocution.
Wow, that's quite a subversive thing to do at that time.
Not really. It was very much du jour. It was like piano lessons, elocution. Elocution evolved into speech and drama. It was the idea. She always wanted me. She created a monster. I was never to sit in the back and have nothing to say for myself. That was never an option.
That's very...
Is that of that generation?
That's very influential on a little girl, I think.
It is.
That time.
Yeah. And she, like I remember, I'd get an elbow in the ribs around the time of Thatcher, if Thatcher was on the telly. Not that she agreed with the woman at all, but loved the fact that there was a woman standing up in a room and being listened to. And I think that unfortunately possibly speaks to her own experience.
Mm.
But there was no way on earth that was ever going to happen to me.
So while they didn't really understand the impulse to do the job, it sounds like they helped build the personality that wanted that job, right?
Completely.
So they wanted that kind of strident, made herself heard, made herself seen daughter.
I think so. And also, you know, they respected somebody who was able to speak well. There was something in my family as well, because my the father's side of the family, even though my mother had beautiful Irish, they were all Gaelgores. They all spoke Irish. And that is a very emotional and potent thing in Ireland. My grandfather was a very highly poet. But, you know, he didn't make a living out of poetry. He was the headmaster. And the idea of being able to speak well, I can't describe it anything more than that. The ability to declaim a poem, there was something that it was almost your birthright or your obligation to do. The idea of being able to stand up and to give a poem. Because I don't think anybody in our family is particularly musical. They haven't come out with it. Like, I can sing along to the radio kind of thing, but it's never been our yen. Do you know mm-hmm. what I mean? But to stand,
it's a Welsh thing.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
We took that one.
He took that one. But to stand up and declaim a poem and to be able to quote and to be able to speak and to, I suppose it's almost rhetoric, to, you know, like, I don't know. I learned early on, because I was thinking coming in here about what you'd ask and, you know, listening to previous episodes and stuff and just thinking myself what I think about myself and how I look and things like that. We all learn very early on what is liked and what is not liked.
Right.
And with my parents, this is a good way that I could describe my parents, I learnt that being quick, being smart, being witty, being able to speak well for myself, they liked that.
Yeah.
And I liked praise.
Yeah.
So I kept going on for that. I knew my mother liked me dressed as a Victorian doll.
What, so like frills, T-bar shoes?
Frills, the whole
shebang. Bonnets.
Because she was an older mam, I think she had a very, like, so I think I sort of was being dressed like a generation behind.
Like a doll she might have had.
Yeah, yeah. Or like maybe what a middle class child of the 50s would have been. Because, you know.
Exactly what you mean.
So lots of starched collars, lots of velvet, lots of you know, bowl haircut with the white lace tights.
And when was the first time you, and it's hard to pinpoint, but can you remember the first time you had a sense of how you looked, either in those kind of crazy clothes or
without a shadow of a doubt, I knew that I looked lovely in those dresses. I knew I looked lovely. And then I wore dungarees. They were wine-coloured cord dungarees. And for some reason, I don't know what happened, but my hair was really short at that time. And I knew I was brilliant in these dungarees.
Did you just feel the business in
these dungarees? I was fantastic. So there's quite a lot of satirical moments in my childhood that I can point out. Like there was also, because I will we'll put a pin in that because there's something really weird happened around those dungarees. But before that, I was a feral, wheezy, gasping, wild child. So there's a fantastic picture of me. I had a cord set of cherry red velour, yes baby, shorts with a hooded top. Oh my God.
I mean, get you.
And I'd long, tangled black hair and freckles and fucking wild eyes. And, you know, I'd love to say I was like, it's Mowgli, but because I'd shit lungs and I was a bit plump, I'm like, I'm climbing a tree. And then sort of, there she is, 2 inches off the ground.
Slide down. Yeah.
Landing with a splat. Oh, bless her. And she's running very slowly. Can't catch me. She fell. You know, like, but outside all the time. Outside all the time. Grew up in the countryside. All that sort of, you know, spoke to the trees. Was convinced, still am convinced, that if you don't see green, you get sad.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's true.
Yeah, I used to get my granddad's glasses that had no lenses in them and wrap leaves around them and look at the sun, so you'd just got the green coming in. And I was like, okay, now I'm healthy.
So you sound a bit like me in that when I have to remember something, I always remember what I was wearing.
Yeah.
I start with the outfit almost and think, oh yeah, so I was in that place and I was wearing that. And it's such a big part of any memory I have. Which is not to say the outfit would have been remarkable.
No.
I'm not saying I was in some fabulous thing, but I can remember what it was typically.
It's, for me, clothing is hugely important. And if I don't remember, it's because, it's not that if I remember the clothes, I remember what was happening. It's like, even when I deal with character, once I know the costume, we're halfway there. We're halfway there. And I know how important clothing and appearance is for how it makes you feel and what it makes you feel. So when I was talking about those burgundy dungarees, my parents had, our family friends lived in the nearby town. And for years, their neighbours thought I was a boy. And I never just, you know, convinced them otherwise. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing, the reason why I'm not going to say that there was, I never thought I was a boy. I never, there's no sort of gender crisis or anything like that. But at such a young age, I realised that it was better to be a boy than a girl. And like the definition for me, with the beautiful overdue and in my house, deeply welcome conversation about trans issues. When I thought back to that moment and I thought, well, the difference is that I knew I was not a boy.
Yes.
That's the difference. That's what,
yeah.
That's why there's no confusion in my head.
But you knew that
it was
politically,
better.
Socially.
That's right. It was better.
It was easier. It was better.
Yeah.
And do you still feel that way now? Because I think, so I have four brothers, and so I always looked like a boy. I had my hair cut with them, wore their clothes.
Yeah, right, okay.
But I much prefer being a woman. I wouldn't want to be a man, would you?
I much prefer now being a woman. For me, that freedom of being, that freedom that the neighbours thought I was a boy for two summers.
Yeah.
And that freedom came down to, which I think is probably an experience both universal and unique to me, is the quality of being looked at.
Yeah.
I was being looked at in a different way. Maybe there were different expectations of me, but for me, it's all got to do with the gaze. It always does. And the quality of the looking, because I think that actually has, it's very much a driving force as to why I act as well and to how I look. And to why I look the way I look and things like that, and why I choose certain things.
Say more about that. That's interesting.
Well, I only remembered and sort of investigated a few years ago that when I, not hit puberty, but when I was in university, but still quite young, like an older teenager, I distinctly remember being catcalled. And
I mean, it was constant when in those days.
Yeah, but like everyone, I'm sure, you know, you feel sick and you feel disgusting. Yeah. And I felt gross. I felt like
it's also a bit scary.
Yes. And to this day, every time I pass that that quay in Cork, I remember it. What I'd forgotten was that I started wearing a really big coat after that. And what I'd also forgotten, I started putting on a lot of weight. And, you know, weight has been talked about to death. And frankly, it's nobody else's fucking business. But I don't think that it's an accident, because there's something that all fat women will tell you about the quality of how they're looked at, how it changes, which is you are defeminized. Your womanhood is stripped of you. And I'm talking about a certain gaze, obviously the prevalent straight cis male gaze, right? You get stripped of your womanhood.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very safe place to be.
Yeah. So are you saying that subconsciously you wanted to rid yourself of that sense of womanhood so you'd be left alone?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I'm not sure. I might think about it a bit more and change my mind. But It something about that rings true to me.
I would suggest that if on some level you feel it, it's probably there to some degree.
I agree, to some degree. And also, I would also say very, very, very subconsciously, because also putting on weight would have been because I was having lovely food.
I mean,
I was enjoying every second of it.
It's a silver lining, isn't it?
but there's definitely, yeah, there's something there, be it 0.1%, but it's there. And I think that also relates to the safest place I feel in the entire world is on stage. Not in front of a camera, but is on stage.
Yeah.
I feel incredibly safe. I feel loved. Not in a adoring way, but in a parental way. Like I feel, if I believed in God, I'd feel that I was being wrapped in his love or something. I feel it's grace. I feel like I'm filled with grace.
I want to come back to the theatre because there are some specific things I want to know around that. But before we do, I just wanted to touch on Irish women generally. So my experience in my job, so anyone in my family will tell you that Irish events, consumer events that I do in Ireland, so I go to Brown Thomas or, you know, whatever, or a theatre there or something, Irish events are the ones I always look forward to, right? And the reason I particularly look forward to them, the reason I love doing them, is that Irish women love beauty, right? They love it. They love it. They come and they're dressed up to the nines and they always make an evening of it. I always say, what are you doing now? And they're going out for cocktails. They're going out for dinner with their girlfriends. You know, they've all come together. They really, really love it. And they always are the most glam kind of audience. And I wondered, your mother sounds quite serious, as much as she was fun and everything. She sounds serious about life and womanhood and so on. And I was wondering, was there any part of that kind of sense of glam, dressing up Sunday best, within your family, or was that something you saw on the outside more?
No, definitely, definitely. She was a deeply glamorous woman. And I know in a way, I think we all think that our mammies are deeply glamorous, but she was deeply glamorous. And before she had children and before she was married, she was renowned for her glamour. And, you know, she's, I don't know if she made her own frocks, but she always had the fanciest things ever. And do you know what? I have pictures of her now and I'm like, yeah, she's a ride. She's an absolute, she knew, and she was quite outrageous, you know, like West Cork and she's swanning around in a beehive and next summer in a beret looking like Che Guevara and, you know, in a glamorous trench coat. And then, you know, at her funeral, people I never met before or since just talking about how fucking glamorous she was, how she brought a little bit of colour and I think the word outrageous is coming to mind, but she wasn't, she was, you know, she was good crack. She was very good crack, very funny. But yeah, a bit outrageous, not afraid of colour, you know, A lot, it's so interesting what you say about those women in Ireland, because I think, even though I hate discussing class in Ireland when I'm here, because the majority of people in Britain, if not England, think it's the same class system. Of course it isn't. It has a completely different thing. We don't have the f***ing monarchy at the top.
Uh-huh.
But there is a class system. And I do find the glamour of Irish women is quite often a class thing, in that they want to look their best.
Mm-hmm.
They want to look respectable.
I mean, it's the same in Wales. A working class woman would not be seen dead.
No. And there was
looking rough.
And there was something like, because I was educated, I went to a so-called good school. I had access to a different class of person in my education. The fact that I did not comb my hair and I did not put on the lipstick was a source of constant bewilderment to the women in my family, because that is what you do. You look respectable when you leave the house. Whereas I was reaching puberty, teenagerdom in my young 20s, the time of Riot Girl and grunge. So you look as ugly as you can.
Yes. The posher you get, the scruffier you get.
Right?
I mean, that's a fact.
Yeah, it's the same as, like, you know, the aristos all eat with their hands. Throw bones to the dog or the poor, whatever. They're the same, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like this sense of self-respect was of vital importance throughout the women, however it showed up. So it sounds like modesty wasn't important, which I love to hear whenever I'm talking to a woman who's roughly my age. This sense of kind of decorum and modesty and not being seen was not a thing. That you were allowed to put yourself forward, you were encouraged to put yourself forward.
There's a real push and pull with that, because at the same time, the idea of having notions, or the same idea of thinking too well of yourself.
Yeah.
And like I deliberately speak very well of myself. I deliberately, because I love hearing when other women's, when anyone, I love hearing when men speak well of themselves.
Yeah.
Like, especially, you know, when I wore that jumper and I felt really nice. I'd lie down in traffic for any man who said that, because it's such a lovely thing for you to feel.
It is.
And, you know, fake it till you make it. So I say nice things about myself, even if I don't feel it, because then at some point it'll kick in, or it has kicked in, or somebody will hear it and be shocked. It annoys people. I know it annoys people when I sort of go, don't I look lovely in this?
I love it.
And it does annoy people. And it makes, and you know, that makes me perversely happy to annoy them. But also, I'm like, that's, you know, God love you.
Are you a compliment giver?
I am.
If you think a nice thing about how someone looks,
oh, I have to say it.
Yes. Yeah.
I have to say it. And I have to say, like, and my heart, I paused there when you asked me for a compliment, because I can tend to get overwhelmed with how lovely I think somebody is. So I have to ration it. But when I see some, like when I see somebody with their best frock on, I want to cry, because there's nothing more beautiful. When I see my nephew a little bit strutty because he's wearing his good
peacock
jumper, I want to eat his head. Do you know what? I just want to eat him up because he's divine. And you know, I remember, oh my God, my lovely infuriating dad came up. I tricked him into seeing me in a play by telling him that the free transport he was entitled to, being a pensioner, would not allow him to travel to the north of Ireland. By God almighty, he got on that train. He took three trains just to go, aha, I proved you wrong. And I went, oh yeah, you're in Belfast now, let's go to the play. But the crater, he turned up in a suit and he was wearing the ugliest fucking tie I have ever seen. Well, I know full well I had seen it, because it was my tie that I wore for a comedy sketch. It was a tie made out of plastic that had, it was black with lipsticks,
lipstick kisses all the way down. Yeah, yeah.
Now, my father was many things, but he was not the lipstick kiss tie wearing man.
It's like an amusing stag night prop kind
Completely.
Of a tie.
But he came off the train from Cork and there was this woman beside him. I'm like, what the f-? Oh, and anyway, she went, well, bye-bye now. And I went, fuck off, as if I was herding away. And I said, what the? And he was, you know, God love him, naive as the day is long. And he was like, I got great compliments for my tie. And I went, I bet you did. He had no idea.
Floozy.
Some floozy that came on in Meath or somewhere. Get back home, you harlot. But he was so delighted with himself, and he felt lovely.
Yeah.
Because everybody feels lovely when they have a little, when somebody has a little flirt with them or, you know, or wanted to talk to him. He was suddenly like, oh God almighty, you know. And it was, I was disgusted. Like, I hid the tie in the hotel. And he said, do you know, it was so weird. The tie was behind the bathroom. We don't know how it got behind the toilet, but yeah, I found it anyway.
You hid away his fanny magnet.
Yeah. I mean, the ultimate cock blocker. But the way he thought he was so lovely in it, you know?
It's adorable.
It's adorable. And people wanting to look nice is adorable.
You mentioned the theatre a few times there. I know it's your big love and actually was the main focus of your career for a long time. Right?
Yeah.
The nature of being a theatre actor means you often have to get yourself ready,
mm-hmm.
right? You have to get yourself into character. Tell me about that. Were you a natural? Did you not get your head around it for a while? Tell me about the process.
It quite often depends on the show. So I started off in theatre and I would be playing 47 parts, and some of them just involved changing of a hat and going out again and running or whatever. The thing about theatre is that you don't rehearse in the clothes more often than not.
So you're in your civvies.
You're in your rehearsal clothes, and depending on whether it's a period piece, you're in a skirt and, you know, plain top, or whether it's a modern piece and you're wearing your trackies so you can move properly. Getting ready is an interest. I always want to be the actress that has, you know, along with the red velvet curtain, the light bulbs around the mirror is another iconic, almost epigenetic thing that I get fizzy around.
Yeah, it's and like a bit of a Gloria Swanson thing, isn't it? Yeah,
isn't it? And I want to be Gloria Swanson with lovely soft focus and have the towel out and all the makeup brushes and number two down the nose, darling, and my Pond's cold cream afterwards. It's not like that at all. I've got one foot in a shoe, you know, shoving chips into my mouth and doing on that or whatever. It's the getting ready mostly for me is getting into the calm mindset. For theatre, it's so interesting how with theatre, the sort of the work that the costume does and the makeup does and the wig does, because you're doing runs and you're repeating it, so it literally becomes second nature. Whereas in film and TV, it still is a novelty every time you get into it. Every time I wore my pixie boots, every time I put on my skirt as Sister M, every time I wrestled with that wimple, it was an event. Whereas in theatre, you get used to them, to what you're wearing. Yeah.
Because it's half your life for a while, I suppose.
Yeah.
You love television. I've heard you talk lots about the importance of television in shifting how we feel without us really noticing, right?
Yeah.
Making us under. I mean, Derry Girl's a brilliant example of that.
Yeah.
More people came out understanding.
Yeah.
The problems in Northern Ireland and the political landscape in Northern Ireland than they ever had from watching the news, for example.
Yeah, or being not taught it in school.
I mean, we absolutely were not.
I know that's true. I've actually seen the syllabus, and each time I'm like, I can't believe that's true.
True. Absolutely. That was the. I mean, all I knew about Northern Ireland as a child was the IRA. That was it. I mean, we didn't learn about it at all. And so, this power that television has now to make people understand and acquire really, frankly, essential knowledge about
and complicated knowledge.
Complicated knowledge, but through a human lens.
Completely.
Do you find that TV, given that it wasn't kind of, you know, how you started out or where you thought you'd stick, it seems to have massively welcomed you to its bosom. Like, you've become a mainstream TV celebrity really quickly.
I know, isn't it mad? No, I
Are you surprised?
Yeah, I am. I am. I never wanted to be a presenter. It never was on any sort of wish list or anything whatsoever. That, like, I remember being told the figures for how many people watch Pottery Throwdown. And I can assure you, per episode, it's 3 times as much as watch Derry Girls when it was going out live. So I was in, you know, when you're working in comedy drama, like not factual, you know what I mean? The made up stuff. You think you're the centre of the world. You think that, well, you know, has anyone watched the latest blah, blah, blah? And you're like, oh, yeah, no, it's people are mostly watching Ant and Dec. People are mostly.
Right.
Mostly, what do you? Nobody's going. Have you seen the latest Beckett? They're watching a panel show, or they're watching me jump around dressed as a clock.
And so, did you? I mean, you probably know exactly, but did you get the Throwdown because of your appearance on Bake Off?
I think
as
so.
A contestant.
Yeah, what happened in Bake Off as a contestant? I think they knew that they were. I think Sandy had told them that she was leaving. I don't know the ins and outs, obviously. But they were looking for, they knew that they would be looking for a new presenter. And very much with Love Productions, from what I can tell, they seem to sort of cast in-house, you know, because everybody seems to go through.
One of their own.
Yeah, everybody seems to go through their celebs or the stand up to cancer kind of thingies. Doesn't it seem to that? Because yes. Harry Hill does the junior one, and oh God, he's fucking class in it. And
he's unbelievably good on it.
Oh, so good. He's perfect. He's just so good. But obviously, I didn't know that when I was doing the charity Derry Girls Bake Off, and afterwards they came and they said, "Would I like to sort of do a little test, see if I'd like to do pottery?"
Let's take a quick pause on this episode to thank our series sponsor, Clinique. Clinique believes that great-looking skin doesn't have to be complicated, and obviously I quite agree. Over 50 years ago, Clinique changed the beauty industry forever by being one of the first to offer a dermatologist-developed skincare ritual outside of the dermatologist's office, the iconic three-step routine, cleanse, exfoliate, and moisturise. Clinique was the first premium brand I ever owned, and truly, there hasn't ever been a single time in over 3.5 decades since, where I haven't had something Clinique in my bathroom cabinet. From the original Clinique computer that helped women understand their skin, to today's innovative clinical reality diagnostic tool, Clinique has always led the way in helping you to truly understand what your skin needs. They offer solutions for every skin type and concern, and Clinique's makeup and skincare products are dermatologist tested, allergy tested, and 100% fragrance free. Discover your best skin at Clinique, where great looking skin begins. You've mentioned yourself what TV, what women on the telly looked like.
Yeah.
And you always had this understanding that you didn't look like them, you didn't represent them. But you're such a mainstream TV celebrity now.
Yeah.
And so are a fair few people who don't fit that 1970s mould of the kind of person who'd have a career on telly. What's shifting?
Nothing.
Okay, tell me about that.
I don't think anything has shifted at all. I don't think it is getting better. I don't think it. I think there are exceptions that prove the rule. I think they're myself and those other women are perhaps anomalies, or perhaps lucky. With presenting, I think the less I know, the better.
Yeah.
And that has been my biggest strength.
Yeah.
But in general, I don't think things have changed. In general, like the reason why I think that when you say, oh, you know, the 1970s glamorous, the reason I think that women like me are an anomaly is because I've been repeatedly told that.
By people in power,
the industry, in TV? Repeatedly told that. They don't tell me so much now because they look foolish.
But what kind of thing? How would they even broach that? What kind of thing?
From casting directors going, she was the funniest girl we auditioned, but we'll go with the pretty one. From constant drama teachers telling me, you're very good, but you won't work. You'll work when you're older.
Wow.
From directors telling me, you're very good, we need you to come. From another casting director saying, you're so good, you're so good, I've got just the part for you. The part was called Fat Cook, with one line. This is after Derry Girls.
After Derry Girls.
Yeah,
wow.
This is how good that industry is, by the way. And to be constant, as if I'm in on the secret. That's what I used to always be sort of like. They'd look knowingly at me and going, well, of course, you'll find it very, very difficult in the industry. And I'm like, why?
Yeah.
I worked hard. I went to Central, which is a really good drama school, a very small school.
Yeah.
I did really well there.
Yeah.
Why aren't you saying this to that anorexic girl who played my maid? Mm-hmm. There's my lovely naivety going. It took me a while to sit down and go, but why? What's the difference between me and?
And will you say something when you hear those things now?
I don't get it now.
You don't get it now because you're famous.
Yeah, I think so.
And, but somebody's getting it.
And I've
somebody
aged.
Who looks like you or is in the...
I've aged up, you see.
Yeah.
I'm older now.
Yeah.
And also you can't say that now.
Yeah.
So that's what's changed.
Yes, people are thinking it and doing it but not saying it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God, I'm sorry. I'm really angry about this. That's sort of why I've been very vehement about it. Like, if you caught me yesterday, I'd be laughing and I'd be far more glib about it. But like,
but you should be angry. It's fine to be angry. You've certainly come to the right place.
Sorry, I wasn't mooing. I was just having a sip of water there.
I mean, it must be galling because you're not getting it now because you're famous and you've done well and so you're accepted. You're making money for people.
Yeah.
But somebody's getting it. A younger version of you is getting it still.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. They are, and I don't know. I listen, my aim is to get as powerful as I can so that those stupid voices that are also incorrect, as well as just stupid, which is a double whammy. Like, it's bad enough that they're incorrect, but to be stupid.
Yeah.
That I protect myself and as many people as I can from those voices.
Right. Colleagues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose all of this can be changed once you change the stories that we value. And we've been told that only certain things are valuable. I'm not saying that things are changing, but there is at least an acknowledgement that there are other stories now.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's fucking commissioning them, but there are other stories.
I mean, nobody's commissioning comedy.
Well, nobody's commissioning anything, as far as I can tell.
Yes. On about that. As someone married to a comedy writer, it's...
It's really depressing.
Yeah.
It's really, really depressing out there because then what happens is that, understandably, because it's a business, people go, and they go back for the lowest common denominator, which makes people not want to watch it anyway because it's just bland. It's vanilla. And it sort of perpetuates the problem again.
The antithesis of this, or rather speaking about power and taking up your space in the world unapologetically, can we talk a little bit more about Sister Michael? My son, my youngest son, who's 17 and a half, loves Sister Michael so much. He loves her. He loved her from the very first episode. I think you are like his favourite character.
Oh my gosh.
The boys in Peep Show and Sister Michael.
Wow.
Those are his dudes.
That's good company.
Because in a way, although she's an old soul, she's sort of like a child in that she just says what she thinks. I mean, there's no lying, is there? There's no front. It's out there.
But she also, it's all like, because it's almost like she stayed in the Burgundy dungarees.
Yeah.
She's never, ever, ever had to adapt any thought or feeling she's had.
Which is actually the sort of power of nuns. Lots of women became nuns for that reason, right?
Yeah.
So they didn't have to give up their identity to a man. They didn't have to get married. They could continue to work. They could continue to have their own life.
Yesterday I went to, which is possibly why I'm sort of a bit punchy today, but I went to the medieval women exhibition and there's a lot of, it's fascinating. They have like Joan of Arc's signature.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and she can barely write and it's so interesting. But they have a lot of like nuns there and a lot of cloistered nuns and a lot of text from nuns. And quite often it's the only text we have of women that isn't sort of, you know, how to please your man.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. It's a very, very moving exhibition for a trillion things. But it reminded me of... Like it's, I can see this is the pull quote already, you know, comedy nun says that she would have been a nun, but like the appeal of it.
Yeah.
For every, you know, and caresses that would like literally brick themselves up and not engage with the world for the rest of their lives. For every two men that did it, five women did it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, damn right.
It was the only way to have a life for lots of women, wasn't
right?
it? To kind of keep control over
completely
their own time.
And to not die in childbirth.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And to not be prodded and looked, yeah, ugh.
So there's no prodding, Sister Michael.
Well, she'd prod back, so.
Yeah. How transformative was the look of Sister Michael? I mean,
hugely.
She's literally in a uniform.
She is, but there are so... This is why I love costume. There are so many little... she's so vain, which is very wrong for a nun.
Yeah.
But she has these moments of vanity, which are so adorable. The costume was never a uniform. It was never a uniform. And there's a huge transition, even though superficially it doesn't look like it at all. Huge transition between series one and series three. Series one, she's almost like a young communist, you know, or like, you know, those hippies or, you know, socialists that went out to the kibbutz or something in the 70s. Like she has her shirt is cotton or cheesecloth. No filigree, no brooches, nothing whatsoever.
A bit of a Che Guevara vibe.
Completely, yeah. You know, her little Mao Zedong in her back pocket. She's plain, you know, it's rice and beans. She's plain and simple and punky in that way. And I think for her, she by the end, the way she looks, which is in with brooches and with synthetic ivory blouses, with fake mother of pearl buttons and big collars with bits of lace on them and everything. That's the nun that everybody thought that Sister Michael would be in the first series, because that's a generic nun. And actually she has to become that. So you do get her little journey all the way there. She also loves her country music. She loves her line dancing. This was something that myself and this is something that I thought about her, because she's so country, and there's a kind of, you know, Irish country music is so its own thing, you know, and it's the Wild West in so many ways. And she has her little, I can't remember what they're called, but you know, the tie that is two straps going down.
The boot lace.
Yes.
Tie. Boot lace.
And she had cowboy boots when she was on the bus.
Yeah.
It was detailed. It was so detailed. So detailed.
How much does costume give you
everything
in your performance?
Everything.
And makeup and everything.
A lot of the characters I play don't have huge makeup looks. I mean, in Pottery Throwdown, that's where I wear the most makeup because it's so much fun. Sister Michael wore no makeup. But costumes, everything. The look, the stuff I put on is everything for costume. It's the most important thing. It's like the text tells me what to say, the clothes tell me how to say it, in a way.
I wonder if that's because clothes are so important to you. It's how you express yourself. So
yeah.
It might help you to express how somebody else.
And it's also how I read other people.
Right.
It's how, there's so many visual clues, and there's lots of tenderness in clothes, and there's so many secrets, and there's love in clothes. And it feels like a poem if you see somebody's odd socks or something. Like, that sounds a bit wanky, but, like, you know, there's something very tender and intimate about how somebody chooses to present themselves in the world.
Did you lose your clothes in your fire, or did you not lose much?
I lost my clothes, yes.
You lost your clothes. So I just want to give you some background here. So you, unbeknownst to you, I think probably in many houses, including my own, where you allowed my husband to win a very long argument he'd been having with me. We don't have multi-plug adapters, which are those cubic plastic adapters you put in a plug hole and then you can plug three things in.
That's right.
Right. So you had one of those in your flat.
Mm-hmm.
And then what?
So they can have varying, but I think mine had at least three sockets in them.
Yeah.
And they only work if all three are plugged in, because then it's a balanced item. And I had plugged out my fan on my bedside table, which was one of the three things that I had plugged into it. As a result, the cube was unbalanced and came out of the socket by a couple of millimetres.
Uh-huh.
In that millimetre of a gap, an electrical arc was created, which sparked and went onto my mattress, which went on fire, and my flat, my mattress was also embarrassingly incredibly old, so it was very toxic.
Right.
It's not like those new ones now. It was that old. So the entire flat was, the room was, the plasterboard burnt back to brick. The windows were all broken from the heat, and the rest of the flat was covered in smoke damage.
I mean, and you can't get rid of the smell, and there's,
oh my gosh.
You just have to get rid of things.
Yeah.
So you lost your clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And has to
think,
start again.
I think there was one item of clothing Sarah O'Neill had given me, a beautiful kimono that I wore to the first year of the BAFTAs. And I spent £200 on getting it properly dry cleaned over and expertly so. Because it was so precious to me. It was also the most expensive thing that I would have ever owned. I wasn't going to be doing that with every other item of clothing.
Sure.
So most things got put into the bin.
I mean, lots of memories attached to those things.
Sure, can't remember one of them. Truly.
I mean, that's a traumatic thing to happen.
Yeah. Oh, it was. It was. But, you know, at least then 6 months later, COVID happened.
Sunshine.
No, what happened? Dad had died. Dad had died a year before, and a month before, my beloved Auntie Betsy, who had sort of his sister who'd taken, you know, who was my maternal figure after mum died, had died. Then the flat burnt down. But that's all right, because then a global pandemic in which I was deeply...
Anything else? A diagnosis? Anything?
Like that? I developed anxiety during COVID.
Well, I bet you did. If it was hot on the heels of the fire, is
yeah,
that what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, how did that manifest? That anxiety,
paranoia, sleeplessness, palpitations, wretchedness—just feeling wretched, just feeling that moment before you. You know, which I do, which is fall a lot. You know, when you take a step in the dark and you sort of miss how that feeling where your stomach is about to jump into your mouth the whole time, that for days and days and end. It's horrible. It's a real thing, isn't it?
And what was the passing of that? Or was it one of those things? Which
medication.
You didn't know? Yeah.
Medication. And
more people should say that.
Yeah. Medication and meditation. And the global pandemic ending and being allowed... The primary reason was because I was shielding. I couldn't leave my flat for 3 months. I wasn't literally allowed to leave my one bed, small flat for 3 months. And during that time, I got offered Pottery Throwdown. And they said, we promise you won't get ill. I mean, they didn't, because you can't do that. But if you remember, Bake Off was the first show in the world.
Yes. I was talking to the makeup artist on that and they were so strict.
Yeah.
She was telling me that they would get their dinners delivered, but they had to stay in a holding pen. These dinners had to stay in a room on their own for a couple of hours to make sure they active.
We were washing bags of flour. Remember, we were washing everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they did the same thing for that series of Pottery. It was, in fact, more difficult, but because they'd had the experience of doing Bake Off where nobody got sick, and we were all bubbled in various ways. Fair play to Love Productions. Do you know what I mean? Nobody got sick. Nobody got sick. We had a false positive.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only thing we had. Isn't that remarkable, really, when you think about it?
It is.
4 months.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a long
time. But
that's
it. I think that, you know, that definitely helped because I was out in the countryside.
Yeah, and you need to touch green.
Yeah.
You mentioned meditation there.
Yeah.
And I know you like a bit of a skincare moment, don't you? You
like.
Do you need those little moments of self-care for yourself? You strike me as somebody who probably likes their own company.
I do. I do like my own company. As deeply and as importantly as I love other people's company.
Yeah, same.
And I never think of things as being self-care. I think of, I don't know, I mean, it doesn't matter. It's only semantics if you say it's one thing or the other. But my favourite thing to do in the whole wide world is wake up, make the bed, put on the heating, open the curtains and make a cup of coffee, sit on the bed with a blanket over my knees in my pyjamas, and listen to Radio 3.
I mean, that's heaven, isn't it?
But I don't know what it is about that. Like, why can't I do it at any other point of the day? What is it about? Like, that moment, I feel like it feels... Again, I'm doing all these... Maybe it's because of medieval women, but it feels, like, again, like grace. It feels like a prayer or something. I, again, have to emphasise, I have no faith. I am anti-religion, frankly, But I do believe in... grace, and I believe in internal peace and transcendent. I can't pronounce it, but I believe in it. And those moments, if that's self-care, bring it on. But I can't have the second cup of coffee. Do you know what I mean? It's those moments.
Yeah, you got to get on.
Yeah. And I do love a skin that came around, like, I think with so many people with skincare, that moment was because of lockdown. What else would I be doing?
Yeah.
I look up the chemical component of hyaluronic acid.
Would you? So you'd get really stuck into your skincare.
Well, I'd need to know where I can get the cheaper version because I know it's all a fad.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like,
Well, and you're a science graduate.
And I am. Yeah, yes. Yeah. No, I was a shit science student, so I don't think I'm relying on anything like that. But yeah, that I love my... And I'm not working too much at the moment, which is lovely. And not like for the first time ever, I don't feel anxious about it, and I don't feel like I'm lazy, and I don't feel like I'm wasting time.
Yeah.
So I'm really enjoying doing my 3,000 Korean step skincare system in the evening. I mean, of course, what I'm talking about is actually just washing my face. But, you know, and I'm like, oh, well, I'll put a bit of this on. I'm a lady and I put this on.
I mean, you do have lovely skin.
Thank you. Thank you.
You do have very nice skin.
I do. And I think that's why I think if I had bad skin when I was a teenager, I would have had a completely different aesthetic.
Yeah.
And a completely different attitude towards these things. But because both sides of my family we've fucking gorgeous skin. I think it's because we're always indoors reading.
Yeah.
I never, ever had,
It can be devastating for young people have problems.
My brother had spots or acne or something, I remember, for a little while. We sort of didn't know what to do with him. It's like, well, what? They're there. It's like, oh, that must be awful.
Yeah.
That
it
must
can be
awful.
Really devastating.
It really can. And my heart and friends of mine who are getting it now during perimenopause. And also my grunge aesthetic, it worked perfectly. And it meant that I've only ever worn makeup as a choice.
Yeah.
And as a bit of crack. Yeah. It's always fun.
Yeah.
And it's always...
There's no sense that you're having to cover something up to make yourself feel better.
And often when I wear makeup, it's to show that I'm wearing makeup. I've never had to hide it. Even though I do get cold sores. And
cold sores are miserable.
Yeah, they are.
They hurt.
They hurt.
And they feel uncomfortable.
They feel uncomfortable. And your body is...
you feel fluid.
Inflamed.
Yeah,
you do.
Horrible.
And you get sweats and you get... Yeah, it's a really horrible thing. But also, you know, you're not putting makeup on it anyway. So it isn't as if you're doing anything. You don't want to go out. Makeup for me has always been decorative and fun and icing on top, cherry on top.
So you're doing the Traitors. The Traitors has a very strong aesthetic.
It does.
The way the presenter looks is part of the game.
It is.
So we've got Claudia Winkleman, Alan Cumming. Mm-hmm. Both of them, in very different ways, have a very distinctive look. It's an important part of the game.
It is.
Is that going to be true of you?
Yes. Yes.
Can you give us any clues?
No. I'm sure I can, but I'm so terrified of fucking this up. I'm just not going to talk about it at all. I know. And again, I didn't search for it.
Yeah, but I can see why they chose you. You are a very good choice for that, I think. Because you have to be, to a degree, flamboyant. So I know Claudia, and she is like that. I mean, she's exactly the same, really, on the telly as she is in person. She's flamboyant, and she's really funny, and she's really clever, and she likes people, and she's naughty, and, you know, and she has a strong sense of style.
Yeah.
Right? And so she's such an obvious choice for that show. She's perfect for it. And Alan Cumming, flamboyant, an actor, performative is what you need to be for that specific. It's camp.
It is. Thank you for saying
that. It's sort of ridiculous.
It is. It's like, you know, my mood board, one of the pictures is Clue. Right? Let's go for that. Let's not shy away from what this is, which is a camp.
As tits.
Yeah. But the look I'll be going for, I mean, the thing is, you have Claudia, you have Alan, you have Australian one, New Zealand one, you have all these international ones. And like, I'm calling them by their country, not by presenter. So I am representing Ireland in that moment. And
it's one of those funny shows, isn't it? A bit like you're never bigger than the show.
Yeah.
Because the show is so...
That's right.
It has such a strong identity of its own. It's like Mastermind or Desert Island.
Right?
Discs or something.
Yes.
Never bigger than the show.
No, never bigger than the show. But the thing is as well, like, it's also a really new show.
Yeah.
It's a phenomenon, but it is very, very new. We don't know what the future is going to hold for this. Like, the one thing doing pottery, what pottery has taught me is how smart, how literate, how media savvy audiences are.
Yeah.
We have never, ever. We're like our own AIs. We are learning and getting better and adapting to everything we see. We're sponges. And in the history of the world, there's never been so much. Like, a 9-year-old kid will have watched more television than all the years that my dad, before he died, had watched. You know, that's a 9-year-old kid. And you go, so this 9-year-old kid is able to, is so astute and understands storytelling and understands visual storytelling. And they're all editing hilariously on TikTok. And they do all the, these things.
You so, can't get much past them.
No, you can't. And that, I think, is wonderful for the medium, for all storytelling media. But Traitors is telling a story. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it'll be interesting to see how long an audience, just because you have a new geographic area, because we're all so multicultural now and we're all just one big global village, how, like, our audiences are just going to get smarter and smarter and smarter along with it. How long will that show? I don't know how long these things
will last. Exciting journey to be on for you. You must be made up.
Totally made up. I really am. I find it a great compliment and I find it interesting. So it's a perfect combination of the two things.
I mean, I could talk to you all day. I don't think I have ever had a guest, or I can maybe only think one or two, who seem to have such a strong sense of self. You seem to really know yourself.
Oh, gosh, no.
What do you mean by that? What mystifies you?
Crikey. That's thrown me slightly. No, I... what mystifies me so much? I don't think about myself. so I don't know. Maybe this will go in some way to answer. I think what you might be picking up on. So I had the litany of Siobhan's woes. I'm a deeply actually content and happy. Like, I am absolutely very, very lucky and I lead the most charmed life known to humanity. But 3 years ago, I had an accident and I hurt my leg very badly. And
you were on crutches on
the Pottery Throwdown.
I remember that.
I was on crutches and then, you know, they would, what you didn't see is that they actually had the wheelchair ready to scoop me up.
Okay.
And naps while painkillers knocked me out.
How long
and stuff like that.
Were the effects of that like that?
I'm still having, it's a lifelong thing.
What happened, as comfortable as you feel able to talk about it?
Yeah, I had an accident where, for a variety of reasons, I ended up using my leg as a brake. And not as a brake, but using it to steady the bike, and it acted as a brake. So my tibia got completely crushed, and the from, like, not as a fracture laterally, it sort of went through the bone.
A push bike, a cycle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, everything got destroyed behind the knee down and it turned to rubble. And then I developed complications around that. So it's, and in the end, it's one of the worst. Me and professional skiers, Olympic skiers, Siobhan McSweeney, have the same injury.
Okay.
So, but I had the best care, continue to have the best care, and I'm healing magnificently well. And the reason I bring it up is because that accident forced me for the first time in my life to acknowledge the flesh cage that carries my brain around.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never really acknowledged the flesh cage.
I find this very interesting because this has come up in previous episodes.
Has it?
And it's always women roughly our age, right? Who, unbeknownst to them, have not really had a relationship with their body beyond external things like having a baby, having sex, whatever. and they get to a certain age and they think, oh, hello you. I haven't really paid any attention.
No attention. Absolutely no attention. And that was also part of my upbringing. That was part of the society I grew up in and part of my own inclination. All these things, a perfect storm of going, the most interesting thing about me should be my brain.
Yeah.
And as a result, I ended up ignoring the little flesh cage, or not so little, and quite often, very much not so little. And because also being a large woman and refusing to feel shit about it.
Yeah.
Not that always not working. And of course, every person goes through that. But when you are fat, there is a specific set of that not working. There are specific insults and there are specific lines that are, you know, of things that fat women say to themselves or receive from the outside. Everybody has their own flavour of self-abuse and societal abuse put on them. Being fat is one particular flavour of it. And when I, you know, I've been fatter, I've been thinner, whatever.
Have you felt differently when you've been fatter or thinner?
Yes. But it's never to do with happiness.
Yeah.
Happiness has never really come into the equation. I have felt different. And again, it goes back to the gaze. It goes back to how I am perceived. It goes back to my social currency.
So you feel approved of, you feel more accepted, you feel like people are pleased with you if you're smaller.
Yeah. And also,
but it's not really about you.
No.
No.
No. And, you know, if you're a good girl,
yeah,
the best thing to do is to be a good girl.
Yeah.
And I was always a good girl. And recently I've stopped being a good girl. And I think most women's stories are that, frankly.
Yeah.
But the accident, because I had to live in this body and continue to live in this body, that very often is an awful amount of pain. And I physically saw how it healed. Like too huge.
Magic.
It is magic. And I, so my body became this character in my head of this annoying little brother who was always trying to like, oh, can we do this? Oh, what are you doing? You're reading? Can't we go out and play? Can't we? Which I just realised is very much what my actual younger brother was like when we were both younger. But instead of thinking that now, it's sort of almost like a Jungian integration. You know, it's sort of actually I am not my brain and the flesh cage. I am both.
Yes.
But I do have this sisterly love for my lovely little, very thick body in every sense that managed to heal itself.
Yeah, it's magic.
So it is magic. It is magic. And I like, yeah, we all have our stories of not even hate. The hating is very sad and very qualifiable.
But the
indifference is more insidious.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the hating you always knew, this isn't good. It's not pleasant.
Yeah.
But the indifference didn't feel bad. It felt like nothing.
Yeah. It's that moment where you think, I have not shown you any gratitude or appreciation. You look at your feet and you think, well done, my feet.
I know. You carried me.
Good on the feet. You've carried me for decades and decades.
I did the Camino years ago, a little bit of the Camino, 150K or something. It's a medieval, God almighty, I swear.
Medieval this week.
Going medieval on your ass. I know I have, but this was years ago. Oh God, and it's a fucking religious pilgrimage as well.
Yeah.
I am rock and roll. I am Kim Deal. but it's just a lovely walk through Spain. And that was the first time I went, thank you, legs. You got me through that. Well done. Let's have spaghetti.
Yeah, it's a nice reconnection. So what now, having to some degree reconnected with your body, what now do you think when you look in the mirror?
When I don't see me, when you have a lot of people in your life who are no longer alive.
Yes.
I carry them. And because they were all genetically related to me, I carry them in the mirror. So I was watching Pottery Throwdown on Sunday. I was like, oh, Betsy's there. Betsy's there. And Mum's anniversary is coming up, and usually I see her in the mirror. So I've seen, she's been around when I look in the mirror a lot. Dad is continuously there, which is very confusing. Not least, I imagine, to himself.
Is he wearing the tie?
He's around his head like Rambo. He's looking bewildered because I'm looking, it's my eyes going, why are you here? But I have these three people when I look in the mirror. Where am I in that? I only think of my body as a sort of, that's not true. When I look in the mirror, unless it's like, oh, I'm looking well today, or oh, crikey, you know, need to lay off the bread or something for a little while, or it's a big question, that, isn't it? I suppose an easy answer is I see those three people. I see my body as sort of the culmination of all the DNAs before me. And because I won't have children and never wanted to have them, mm-hmm. I feel like a sort of temple for them. is it, the 32 and me or the 30, whatever, mm-hmm. 52 and me of it all. So I see my grandmother's hands. I see more and more I'm looking at my mum's toenails. Mm-hmm. My dad's eyes, Betsy, when I'm wearing full lip and have lots of eyeshadow on her. There she is, jumping away around in Stoke-on-Trent. And I've stopped shaving my legs since the accident because I sort of feel one less thing to hurt my lovely little leg with. And I love how they look. I love the aesthetic of that now. But that's mine. That's the one thing I have. I don't know. I see my dad's flat arse. My mum had a magnificent bosom, and I have a magnificent bosom. But after she was more maternal than me because I suppose she had breastfed and what have you. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good answer. Siobhan McSweeney, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I've just loved having you here.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for listening. There are so many more conversations in the archive. You can go back to previous series and listen to those. I mean, you'd be lucky to find a conversation as good as that one, though. Thank you so much for coming. I've absolutely loved it. And I will see you next time. Thanks for listening. Beyond the Bathroom is written and hosted by me, Sally Hughes, and is an Insanity Studios production. The head of production is Charlotte Mason, the head of digital is Ed Buckley, and the production assistant is Abby Sandler.